Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to What I Wish I'd Known. Please be advised that in this episode, there are discussions of topics that some listeners may find upsetting.
Hello, and welcome to What I Wish I'd Known, in association with Speakers for Schools, the youth social mobility charity that provides inspirational speakers and work experience opportunities. I'm Alice Thompson.
And I'm Rachel Sylvester.
And in this podcast, we talk to extraordinary people who've lived astonishing lives, brushed with displacement, disease, financial ruin, abandonment, bereavement. And not only have they survived, but thrived.
Loss and adversity are a part of life, but an imperfect past isn't always an indicator of what's to come.
But why is it that often the people with the hardest beginnings in life become the most successful adults? And is there something to learn from these people, who perhaps have the strongest sense of what matters most?
In this series, we'll be speaking to a collection of remarkable individuals on how they achieved success in the face of adversity.
And we'll be reflecting on some of our greatest interviews to date with new thoughts and revelations. Welcome to What I Wish I'd Known.
In this episode of What I Wish I'd Known, we're taking a listen back to one of our favourite interviews with former Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Serving from 1997 to 2007, Blair is the second longest serving Prime Minister in modern history after Margaret Thatcher, and is the longest serving Labour politician ever to have held office. He once said, "I've learned a lot in government and I've learned a lot since leaving government. The kind of journey of being in government is that you start at your most popular and least capable and you end up at your most capable and least popular."
We've interviewed Blair lots of times over the years about everything from Brexit to the Middle East, education policy, babies. But this was the most interesting and revealing interview that I think we've ever done. He talked about the childhood that shaped him and what drove him to be a politician.
It is extraordinary that he was a very personable and very warm politician in many ways, but we never knew much about his childhood. And he was born in Edinburgh in Scotland in 1953 to his parents, Leo and Hazel, and had a fairly stable beginning in life, moving to Adelaide, Australia at just 19 months old, and then back to the UK in Durham when he was 5 years old for his father's job. And he remembers this very strong sense that he was loved and safe as a child. But his rose-tinted view of the world came crumbling down when he was about 10. His father suffered this severe stroke, leaving part of him paralysed and unable to speak more than two words.
What's so fascinating is that Blair saw this moment as the event that shaped his childhood, as he told us. And it was also the moment that he really decided to go into politics. He describes childhood trauma like that as the spur that creates ambition and drives people on to succeed. He says many of the most successful people he's ever known have something like that. And that's certainly what we found in so many of our interviews.
When he was 40 and I was 10, he had this very serious stroke that basically ended his career and completely changed our lives.
Can you remember the day it happened?
Yeah, I remember it extremely vividly. Waking up in the morning and my mother coming in and telling me that my father wasn't well, and I immediately realised there was, you know, the way children have that instinct, that this was much more serious than just he wasn't well. And then he stayed in hospital for several weeks, and then I remember when he came back home because the stroke had affected his speech, so he couldn't speak. And was sort of semi-paralysed on one side of his body. And I just remember all he could only say the word good and tea. It was terrible for my mother because she spent 3 years teaching him to speak again.
I thought he was extraordinary in that we knew so little. When he was standing at number 10 with his young children and his wife with that mug, he just looked like the ordinary dad, and that's what people thought they were voting for. And I think that's what they loved about him in some ways, and he knew that. So he didn't really dispel that myth. And actually, he had this incredibly difficult childhood. And I was amazed at how tough it had been. He's never had any therapy, but the fact that his father had this stroke and then his mother died when he was very young too, and his sister was in hospital, And you never realised that. You never realised how vulnerable he'd been when he was very young.
What's so fascinating, we've looked into it since we did this interview, the number of prime ministers who have had some kind of loss or trauma at an early age. So of the 55 British prime ministers, 25 lost a parent in their early years, and 69% had some kind of childhood trauma. There does seem to be a pattern, and it's as if it's a mixture of the desire to sort of cover up that pain of the early years, but also perhaps it gives you an empathy and an emotional understanding of what people want and a determination to succeed.
There's also some sense, don't you think, Rachel, that actually it's affirmation, because your parents can't give it to you as much. As, you know, his mother had died when he'd just left university. He was obviously looking after his father from a very young age with his siblings, and his sister had been ill. But that sense that you want some kind of acclamation from others and you're not receiving it from your parents anymore. So you need the voters. And he was very successful at getting voters to vote for him. I mean, more successful than any other Labour politician. And I think he loved them, and he loved that acclamation. And maybe that was partly to do with the fact that he didn't have enough when he was younger.
But the other thing that I think is really interesting about him is that his father was a Conservative, and he in fact wanted to be a Conservative Prime Minister. He was about to stand as an MP, and when he had that stroke, all of those ambitions disappeared. And because his father was a Conservative, he always really understood Tories. He also respected people who voted Conservative and people who are Conservative.
And do you remember, Rachel, he said that strange thing when he said that when he'd gone to school, he would have been a rebel, he thought, and he was to a certain extent, but he thought he might have gone off the rails, but he couldn't go off the rails because he felt the family had gone through so much already that if he also then went off, and it was another worry for his mother and his sister and father and older brother, that would be deeply unfair.
And actually, we went to interview him in his country house during the pandemic, and he had, do you remember, he had a pandemic haircut, his hair down to his shoulders virtually. You can see what it might have been like if Ugly Rumours had taken off and he'd end up as a sort of Mick Jagger figure.
But on the other hand, he still hadn't really done any cooking for years, had he? So he's very much part of the establishment by then, in that I think he'd just cooked an omelette for Leo, his son, and that was the first cooking he'd done for about 10 years. And he hasn't driven a car since he became Prime Minister because he's got all these trappings still. Even in lockdown, he hasn't really, you know, become normal again. I don't know if he ever felt he was normal, actually.
Well, actually, the one thing that you can't escape, even when you become the most powerful person in the country, is your own childhood pain.
You know, a lot of people go through the whole of their youth and they never really have disturbing events. Mm. But when you've had a set of them, then I think it means that you acquire a certain urgency,
right,
in your desire to fulfil yourself.
And also not taking life for granted.
No, and certainly not taking life for granted. That's correct. You know, you can't be sure what's going to happen to you.
Mm.
So you better get on with it. There's no doubt that my father's illness was a formative event. I think it definitely changed the direction of my life and gave me a dimension to my character at an early stage that probably led to a lot of things afterwards.
In this episode of What I Wish I'd Known, British politician Tony Blair tells us his story of how the challenges he faced in his early years built him into the longest-serving Labour Prime Minister in modern history.
We met Blair in 2020, and as the pandemic had just begun, so too had his obsessions for new television series.
State of Happiness is good. Have you seen that one?
No.
Is it Norwegian?
What else is good?
All the Normal People, I thought was very good, I have to say.
I didn't watch that. It seemed a large amount of sex in it.
Yeah. Less sex than you think, actually. So you can watch it with your children without being too embarrassed.
Well, Cherie had it on in the kitchen the other day, and I thought it was pretty...
You had to turn away.
Unorthodox. Have you seen Unorthodox?
No, but I have many friends who told me I've got to see that.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. That's a good one to see, because it's short as well. There are only 4 episodes, so it's not like...
I've got hooked on Madam Secretary. Have you seen that? That's basically a sort of female, powerful Secretary of State.
I literally never watch political things.
No. Okay.
You must have watched West Wing, didn't you?
Never.
Didn't you?
Really?
No.
House of Cards? So what do you...
House of Cards, no.
What do you watch? It has to be non-political if you're going to watch something.
Yeah, because otherwise I just get... There's always something that will irritate me about it or sort of get me thinking. It's too much like the day job, so...
Yeah.
Now, what else is there? I mean, it's become a whole thing, though, hasn't it? These shows are now the money makers, really, much more than film. But the Scandinavian ones are really, I mean, they've...
Borgen, that's political, though. The Killing, Borgen. Did you watch all the...
Killing Eve.
Mm. Killing Eve, yeah.
So you can watch anything that's murder series. Or... murder and death, but not politics.
I'm
not too much.
I'm sort of...
Yes, no sex. Completely... It's quite difficult.
No, I don't mind the sex at all, obviously, but it's... the my tastes are incredibly sort of basic and popular. I like things with action. Okay. I like things with a happy ending.
We've always interviewed you in very formal places, either number 10 or it's been in one of your offices in London. Or
yes.
You've always got lots of sort of orchids and black coffee, and now it's roses and beautiful new trees growing.
Yes.
And does that feel rather strange to you now to be here the whole time rather than jetting around the world?
Well, not travelling is quite good, but, you know, we spend a lot of time here anyway. Mm. So I'm used to spending time here, but I never spent 11 or 12 weeks here or indeed in one place for years and years and years.
Probably 30 years, isn't it, since you were in one place for so long?
More than 30 years. I honestly can't remember when I was in the same place without moving for this long, probably since I was a child.
And you were Prime Minister for 10 years, but what we really want to do is go back to your childhood to really to find out what shaped some of your childhood and then what shaped your future and how and your political life and your views and your outlook. And you had a very extraordinary childhood, but it started off quite normally, didn't it? You went off to Adelaide when you were very young. With your family, and it was all rather sort of perfect and idyllic at the beginning, wasn't it?
Apparently you danced on the cruise ship in your nappy, and then the nappy fell down, is that right?
Quite a performer right at the beginning.
Sure.
Yeah, no, that's what my mother always used to say, that what was the acting side of my father's side, I think, probably, that came through. Because my father himself had a strange childhood, being effectively a foster child, but against the wishes of his natural mother. So, and he never really got to know his real parents. So no, we had a perfectly normal childhood. We were in Australia for 3 years, came back to Scotland, then moved to Durham. And then my father was highly successful as a lawyer. He was a barrister and a lecturer. He even had his own little TV slot on Tyne Tees television. And then, you know, when he was 40 and I was 10, he had this very serious stroke that basically ended his career and completely changed our lives.
Can you remember the day it happened?
Yeah, I remember it extremely vividly, because I remember waking up in the morning and my mother coming in and telling me that my father wasn't well. And I immediately realized there was, you know, the way children have that instinct that this was much more serious than just he wasn't well. And so then we went to, she decided to take me to school, but he was obviously in hospital. And then he stayed in hospital for several weeks. And then I remember when he came back home, because the stroke had affected his speech, so he couldn't speak, and was sort of semi-paralyzed on one side of his body. And I just remember all he could only say the word good and tea. He could ask for tea, but nothing else.
That must have been so hard, though.
Yeah, and it was terrible for my mother, because she spent 3 years teaching him to speak again. Because in those days as well, you had much less things available for people. You know, nowadays, I guess you've got a whole set of remedial things that people do for stroke victims. But he'd been overdoing it massively, because he was doing three different jobs. He was on the road the whole time. He was going to become a Conservative Party candidate. I mean, he was the Conservative Party chairman for the area. And he I think he was going to stand for the seat that Geoffrey Rippon then took in Hexham, I think, but I can't be sure of that. And so suddenly our life completely changed. And obviously our income dropped massively.
So what effect did it have on you emotionally? So you went off to school not knowing whether he was dead or alive. How did you feel?
Well, I just knew he was critically ill. It was terrible. I remember, and I sort of, I the headmaster saw me and we sort of said a prayer for him and all of this. And it was, you know, it was the event that shaped my childhood for sure. I mean, when I look back on it, there are so many things that changed. Because then, of course, afterwards, he never fully recovered.
Right.
So he can never go back with a political ambition. He can never really, he practiced the law a bit, but it was difficult for him in court because although his speech came back, it was never as it had been. And for example, he had been a very, very good jazz and popular music pianist. So he played the piano a lot and so on and couldn't really play it nearly as well as he used to. So there are a whole series of things that changed. And yeah, and of course for all of that, by the way, you know, I had a perfectly happy childhood. Mm. I mean, I didn't have an unhappy childhood.
But you must have sensed that huge sense of ambition that your father had and then lost, because he must have had to give up so much.
Yes.
That must be unbelievably difficult for you, wasn't it, as a child?
Yes, it was. And it definitely disciplined me. A, that life was uncertain, and B, it gave me because I was quite wayward as a child. I mean, I think if that experience hadn't happened, I might have gone off the rails perfectly easily. I mean, I was very, very sort of wild at a certain level. And as I got older and I became, you know, this side of my character came out, which was much more sort of wayward, I was always kind of brought back into line by the thought that I didn't want to hurt him or the family, because he was, you know, what did he have other than his children? Mm. Whereas I think, funnily enough, if he'd gone on and become really successful, I could easily have, you know, ended up in a bad way.
Was it very difficult going to boarding school when he'd been ill or not? Or was that a relief?
Well, that was 3 years later. So when I went at 13, I went to school in Edinburgh. But it was always, you know, it was difficult. And because I tried to run away from school and I was almost getting expelled from school and I had problem. But all the time, there was this kind of residual feeling, you know, you don't push it too far because, you know, there's a certain amount of pressure you can put on them and a certain amount you really can't.
And with your mother as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and my mum, who had a very difficult time because my sister was also extremely ill for a time. So around about the same time. So she
was in hospital for 2 years or something, wasn't she?
Yeah. My sister, because at that time she had serious rheumatoid arthritis. And at that time they would treat people with kind of steroids, keep them in hospital. Nowadays, I think, again, they treat people completely differently with that condition. So that was terrible for her and terrible for my mum. And then, of course, when I was 21, my mum died. So that was also. But it's always when you describe it in that way, you think we must have been very unhappy. But we didn't feel unhappy, and we were a close family.
Have felt quite alone, though, that everyone was dealing with quite difficult things, and you had to manage.
Yeah. So my brother, who's older than me, was a very stabilizing and serious kind of influence on the family. So. But, you know, it was fine. I mean, in one sense. But there's no doubt it changed my perspective on life. Because also you start to, when you have a large drop in income in that part of the world at that time, you know, you are aware of the fact. I mean, my dad always used to say you learned very fast who are the people who stood by you and who are the people who drifted away.
Because you said that in one of your conference speeches, didn't you? I remember that sense that you knew who your friends were in adversity. And that must have been extraordinary as a child to even realise that who helped you and who stuck close.
Yeah, no, it was. It was a good education, lessons in life and politics for sure.
Do you think that's where your sort of political ambition came from, that you had this sort of burden of responsibility to fulfil his ambitions politically?
I never know about that really, because I was genuinely interested in issues and even... I sort of, when I was quite young, maybe 12, 13, I actually had some interest. I remember discussing politics, and we used to have prospective MPs come to our house.
Were they always Tory?
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
I didn't. No, actually, they weren't always Tory. No, that's not right, because the MP for Durham at the time, Mark Hughes, was Labour, and Dad knew him. So we would also see him from time to time.
And did you feel more of affiliation with him then than with the Tories?
No, I didn't feel particular affiliation with either, but I was too young. But then I got not interested at all in politics until I became super interested when I was about 20.
Right. And did you have to help your dad learn to speak and making cups of tea and things when he asked for them? Was it almost like the sense of the roles being reversed, that he became dependent on you?
We would spend time with them, yes, and talking with them. I mean, my mother did most of it, virtually all of it. But no, I remember. And obviously, as he started to get his speech back, and this was great, really, for us. But no, it's these things, obviously, you can never be sure where does the ambition and the drive come from is a sort of interesting thing. And I'm never quite sure.
Did your mother have real ambition for you? So did she talk to you about what she wanted you to achieve or do? Or was she just a very stable presence?
She was more of a stable presence, and she was a very kind nature, but quiet. My mother was very shy. My dad was very extrovert. My mother was shy. So, she would have been happy with whatever I did, although she was always slightly worried, you know, when I started to grow my hair long and get into rock music and all of that. Like she wondered where that would lead. But
why do you think you were like that? Because I think Eric Anderson said you're always testing the limits, very differently to, say, Cameron or Johnson, who he knew as well.
I don't know. I don't know. I just came naturally.
What's really interesting to me is that actually your father wasn't particularly religious, but you are quite religious, and obviously were from quite a young age. And that, in that sense, in some ways, you were quite traditional. Because that, to me, is fascinating, that in many ways you were a rebel, but you also did have a belief, didn't you? Which wasn't a particular family belief. It was something that you almost chose yourself.
My religious belief, though, came to me very much through this Australian vicar, Peter Thompson, who was himself a very iconoclastic.
So you weren't religious until university?
No, I mean, I would have been conventionally religious, as it were. You know, you turned up to church with your family because that's what people did. But did I think about it a lot? No. So I only really started to think about it properly when I got to university and met him and thought about religion in a different way from the way I'd been taught. But he was very much, even though people think today of religious faith as a very, very conventional, slightly old-fashioned thing, it wasn't in the way that he presented it. So,
and there was that famous thing when Alistair Campbell said, "We don't do God." And do you think politics sort of drives religion out too much, and actually leaders should be able to speak about their faith?
The trouble is, the reason Alistair said that, and he was right, really, is in the UK context. I mean, he said to me, "I promise you, if you do that, people will say that you're trying to tell people that they're not a proper Christian unless they vote Labour." And right. I remember giving an interview in which I literally, in express terms, said, "I am not saying that if you are a Christian, you've got to vote Labour." And the headline was, if you want to be a proper Christian, vote Labour. So he regarded himself as somewhat justified.
Did your faith really help you when your mother was ill, when you were at university, and then when she died?
When she died, yes. And yes, when I was, because at the age of 10, you kind of accept your religious upbringing as, you just accept it. Yes, it did. I mean, it's helped me deal with a lot of things in life, although it changes over time. And I think the interesting question for the 21st century is, will religion just die out because people think it's inconsistent with science and logic and reason? Right. Or will they find a way to reconnect to and redefine religious faith?
You're listening to What I Wish I'd Known in association with Speakers for Schools with Rachel Sylvester
and me, Alice Thompson. There'll be more from us just after this.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome back to What I Wish I'd Known, in association with Speakers for Schools, with Rachel Sylvester
and Alice Thompson, and our guest on this episode, Tony Blair.
It must have been a real shock to have finished Oxford, had a fantastic time as a student, and then your mother died just at the time when you're looking to broaden your horizons.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it just teaches you also a certain lesson about insecurity. You know, a lot of people go through the whole of their youth and they never really have disturbing events. Mm. But when you've had a set of them, then I think it means that you acquire a certain urgency,
right,
in your desire to fulfill yourself.
And also not taking life for granted.
No, and certainly not taking life for granted. That's correct. So that was a very big lesson. And that's really why after leaving university, I went back to something that's more conventional, which was becoming a pupil barrister, then a barrister, and, you know, being pretty disciplined in the way I led my life. So the long hair came off.
Is that for your mother, really? On. I mean, did you feel that? Did you talk to her at all before she died about what she wanted or from life in a way that... Did she give you any advice before she died?
Not particularly, but I don't even know. Maybe I would have been like that anyway. Mm. But when I look back on it, I think obviously it was just another demonstration of the fact that, you know, you couldn't take life for granted and difficult things happened and you had to make your way in the world.
So when you talk about the urgency, what do you mean? Is that partly political drive as well, wanting to change the world?
Yes, and I think the recognition that, you know, you can't be sure what's going to happen to you.
Mm.
So you better get on with it. But you never know. I mean, ambitions are... curious thing. I mean, I know people who are ambitious and there seems to be no reason for it. or maybe there is and I just don't know the reason. I think in my case, definitely, you know, there's no doubt that my father's illness was a formative event. Maybe I exaggerate in retrospect because you go back over your life and things seem more important than possibly they were. But no, I think when I look at that, it definitely changed the direction of my life and gave me a dimension to my character at an early stage that probably led to a lot of things afterwards.
It's almost fulfilling your father's ambition, isn't it, in a certain sense?
Yes, although, you know, I think I could have taken that into a different sphere. I think my political interest was, It wasn't sort of manufactured at all. It was a genuine interest.
But do you think he'd ever wanted to be Prime Minister, or do you think he just wanted to be an MP?
I think my dad did want to be Prime Minister. He was intensely ambitious. And also he was, because he was from a very poor working class background, he would have been a perfect
manifestation of a different Conservative Party.
Mm. Yes, do you think the Conservative Party would have been very different if he had been leader, really?
No, because I think he would probably have, he would have been part of that whole Thatcherite sort of movement away from the more patrician Conservative Party. So he would have felt at home in that. And he never really stopped being Conservative. I mean, even though he used to come and support me and so on, but that was just because you believed in the family. But no, he was always Conservative.
So when he was out campaigning, did he sometimes say the wrong things?
Yeah, no, I mean, he would, you know, he definitely didn't speak from the Labour speaking notes. Put it right. Like that.
And when you got to number 10, didn't he write a letter to you? Didn't he get a sort of standard stop reply?
Yeah, no, he used to write me letters and he would sign them off, "Your loving Pa." Right. He got this letter back saying, "Dear loving Pa from Downing Street, the Prime Minister thanks you for your..."
What did he say?
We just thought it was very funny.
He must have framed it, didn't he?
I don't know if we still got that letter somewhere. We should dig it out.
But also, don't you think his politics must have informed yours in the sense that it made you realise you had to, if you were going to win power, you had to win over Tory voters?
Yeah, he very much impressed on me. His whole thing about Labour was it holds you back. Labour doesn't want you to fulfil your ambitions. It basically wants you to be a client of the state. That was his whole thing. And, you know, I don't think it's true, but it was it's what a lot of people feel. And certainly at that time, a lot of people were held back from Labour because they thought we were anti-aspiration. And making the Labour Party an aspirational party was a big part of what I wanted to do. But also, yes, it did. It derived from my looking at people who were, you know, should have been strong Labour supporters, but felt, you know, Labour wanted to hold you back. And that was a very, you know, key thing that he taught me. Not he didn't teach me deliberately, but he taught me by his attitude to the Labour Party and why he was one of the very few people, because he'd been secretary of the Young Communists in Glasgow when he was a teenager. And he was one of the very few people who went to the war and came back a Conservative. I mean, most people went off to war and came back and chucked out Churchill and put in Attlee. Right. He voted Conservative.
So when Labour MPs say things like, "I can never be friends with a Conservative," what does that make you think?
Well, it's just stupid, isn't it?
Why?
Because the whole point about a democracy is that you don't hate your opponents, you disagree with them, and then you fight an election. If you win, you get to govern, and if you lose, you've got to do better next time.
Mm.
And also, there's no point in being like that. I mean, people, you know, especially today, frankly, one of the odd things about politics today is that ideologies got back in vogue at a time when ideological answers have never been less relevant. And people always confuse values and ideology. You know, values are really important, but ideology just gets in the way if it ends up becoming structure around policies or prejudices, which it often does.
Mm.
I mean, values is, and that people always think if you're a pragmatist on policy, it means you've got no values. No, it just means that you think the most sensible way of implementing your values is to focus on what works.
And actually, your background was extraordinary in that way because it did manage to merge. You know, you went to a public school. Your father came from a working class background. You had some acting in it. It was such a mix. But all we saw when you became prime minister was sort of very normal dad with a mug and children, didn't we? That we didn't really see much of your background in a way. You just seemed deeply normal, which is actually, you're not really, are you?
Well, I mean, I'm normal in this sense, or I was. You know, the trouble is, you know, the last time I drove a car was the day before the 1997 election.
So
you
get
on all the security. I mean, I always think being in power is a kind of conspiracy to make you as abnormal as possible because of the life you lead. Yeah.
Do you feel that actually because of your experience as a child that you were more, not isolated from other people, but you could make decisions on your own, that you were used to having to be on your own and having to really take responsibility for yourself?
I think it was more that
because I had this very, I did have a strange upbringing, and because of my father also not, you know, having this very odd upbringing himself, I think I had many fewer preconceptions. You know, I didn't, even though I went to a private school, I used to always think there were some people who had generations had gone to private schools and they had a very formed way of thinking. They had certain views that just really didn't change. And one of the things that I think did help me in politics was an ability to kind of understand, because I wasn't so rooted, that I just had a worldview that was very sharply defined. I was much more interested in different people and different cultures, and just because I didn't feel myself, I had this vast tradition behind me.
You're not really from any class, are you? Or it's quite difficult to know whether you're from the North or Scottish or...
Yeah, so all of that was helpful.
Charlie Faulkner, I spoke to the other day, and he said he's known you since you were at school. He adores you. You know, he was Tony's crony. I remember when you call up when he was in the cabinet, you know, hello, Tony's crony here. you were flatmates. You served in government together. And he said to me, in all the time he's known...
Yeah, he did steal my girlfriend, though. So that's...
Never forgive
him. You're never talking to him again.
Well, maybe this explains what he said. He said, ever since he's known you, this is said in a very positive way, you've had an emotional aloneness, was his phrase, and that it's not just independence, it's almost a rejection of dependence. And he thought it's because, having seen what your father went through, the roles were reversed, and that you know, the parent became dependent on the child. And that actually, in some ways, though, that's quite a good preparation for being prime minister, because it's lonely at the top and you need your armour on. Do you recognise that at all?
I'm absolutely hopeless at self-analysis, as you probably realised.
Have you had any sort of analysis done on you, or have you ever seen a psychologist? Or
no, I haven't. I mean, nowadays you sort of say that and people think, oh, so what's wrong with the guy? But, you know, I don't...
And are you glad you didn't as a child? Because you might have now been, you know, with that sort of, those sort of issues and your parents dying.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm hopelessly politically incorrect on all these things, because I just think if you're not careful, you get obsessed with introspection. And, you know, it's also because in the work I do now, and I really mean this when I say, when I go and I visit these countries where, you know, kids will be growing up in a family where at least one of the siblings has died from a childhood disease and the parents are scraping money together and living day by day, you can think that West's desire to just go into endless sort of self-absorbed introspection is not very healthy, but that's probably wrong. I mean, but the fact is I'm hopeless at self-analysis. And I think what Charlie says, yeah, I mean, there may be some truth in that. And he's a very perceptive guy, so...
How would you describe it? So he says emotional aloneness. Do you think that's...
I think you realise... I've certainly realised over time that I'm very fortunate. So I don't... That gives you a certain protection. And I always think, what's the worst that can happen? Okay, the whole thing gets taken away. You're thrown out on the street. Okay, you're still alive. You've still got your brain.
And your family.
And you've got your family.
But do you think that's because you've had something bad happen to you when you were young?
Maybe.
Partly. Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, because you realise you can survive.
Yeah.
But I don't, it's very difficult to know. I mean, there's all sorts of studies now on mental illness and well-being, and, you know, I'm never sure the degree to which you work it out yourself, or you just happen naturally to be optimistic in your nature. And I am optimistic, and just you know, I guess the early childhood could have made me pessimistic, but it didn't.
And what does Cherie say about it? Because she must have an opinion on how it affected you. She must bring
you
it
have
up
to ask. It's probably not wise.
But do you think it makes her feel that you're more vulnerable or less vulnerable? Or...
I don't know. But she had her own strange childhood. Mm. So we both
I mean, the thing both our childhoods have done is put a great emphasis on wanting the family to be a strong family. And so I've two sons now with children, and we're incredibly fortunate in that they're both of their partners are extremely good people. We're very lucky in that. And they're both good dads as well. So much better than I was. So
did it worry you when they were in number 10 that you were going to damage them in some way, that actually it was very difficult to be a child?
Yes.
In number 10, that almost lost you to a certain extent to your job.
Yes, it did.
Because Nikki, I think, was the same age as you were when your dad had the stroke. So it's a sort of...
Yes, I think it definitely... And, you know, you're never quite sure. Because I remember once, a few years back, I mean, but some years after I'd left office, making the mistake once of saying at dinner that, you know, I don't think you guys really had that much hassle as a result of being my children. And I got a very sharp education on what it had been like.
What did they say?
I just that it had been difficult at points. It's at school and without going into detail, she points much more difficult than I realized. But on the other hand, they all said and agreed, look, there are pluses and minuses. We've also met some amazing people. We've got a very lucky start in life. And
do they feel an incredible pressure though to succeed now, or?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so particularly, but I think they're naturally quite desirous of achieving.
Were they trying to protect you, do you think, their number 10, when they didn't tell you how difficult it was?
Yes, I think they did, because they could have told me, and obviously I would have been upset and wanted to act on it as well, but I didn't know and therefore didn't. But, you know, children are quite... It's one of the things you learn about kids is they're quite resilient. They're often more resilient than their parents give them credit for.
Margaret Hodgson said to us that she thought everyone at Westminster, or not everyone, but a lot of politicians were quite mad. And it's such a sort of crazy life. And there's something about the choosing a life where you have to have the external endorsement from the electorate every few years, and it's you're putting your life at risk all the time. Do you think there is something... You have a lot of damaged souls at Westminster, that there's something that drives people into politics often.
I don't know whether they're damaged. I guess politicians are a pretty strange breed.
Why is that?
Because it's a bit of an odd life, isn't it? And it's, you know, I suppose it's like people who go on the stage, or, you know, you've got to have a certain type of personality to want to put yourself in that position. Although, as I always reflect nowadays, what social media has taught us is that there are a lot of strange people out there. Mm-hmm. So they're probably, I mean, journalism, is that different?
Well, so, you only had pages, didn't you, in 97? You didn't have Twitter. It was so different.
Yeah, and it's so different. And it's social media is just such a revolutionary phenomenon in every aspect of it. Politicians also come in different shapes and sizes. I've met some of the worst people I've ever known in politics, and I've met some of the best people I've ever known.
Do you think they're getting better or worse?
I think there's a real problem with the gene pool in politics today, because I think that there's one, if it gets gripped by ideology, smart people either don't want to function in it or can't function in it because they can't get selected unless they're prepared to toe the line. And that's a really crazy thing for political parties to do to themselves. So, you know, for a time it was difficult to get selected. I mean, good Labour candidates did get selected, but, you know, you were also bringing in a whole lot of people who just knew what they had to say for the far left and then said it and get selected. And that's really bad. So I think there's that. But I also think, you know, we don't bring people into politics nowadays who have spent a lot of time outside of politics. And over time, that's going to be a real problem. So democracy, I think, has got a big challenge, which is essentially... So people always want to think of the challenge of politics as around integrity or honesty, transparency, and it's really not. It's the challenge of democracy today is efficacy. It's can you make the system work effectively? Can you take big decisions and drive them through? Do you have the quality of people that really understand the world? And
You know, I think that's where the gene pool of politics has declined.
Is that to do with ideology, or is it to do with the nastiness of political debate, that it's got so much more ferocious?
Well, it's a bit of both, because the nastiness then reinforces the types that go in. And it's not that the people who go in, by the way, are nasty, and, you know, on the whole, they're not, but it can repel a lot of people who otherwise would go in. And I still think there's a lot of, you know, pressure against people who've gone and done something else with their life. You know, whereas if you left university, became a researcher for an MP, then became a candidate and fought a hopeless seat, and then become a candidate for a decent seat, and you come into Parliament, you know, what do you know about life outside of Parliament and politics? And it's not that those aren't necessarily intelligent people, but you learn so much when you're in a non-political environment.
And did you learn a lot as a barrister, do you think, as well as having quite a complicated childhood, that you learned more about empathy and about how people lived? And
yes, I mean, I always say to people that the 7 years I spent as a commercial and industrial lawyer was very, very important for me, because I was mixing with people the whole time. Quite apart from the discipline of sort of learning to analyze and argue cases and so on. But the biggest thing was really the ability to understand what normal non-political life was like, and what it was like for people to run businesses and so on and so forth, and really just to sort of make sure that you understood that the world of politics should start with reality. Mm. It shouldn't start with the world of politics. And knowing that reality and experiencing it is a very important part then of being able to do politics properly, because you then understand.
At the beginning, you were seen as having emotional intelligence as well, weren't you? When Princess Diana died and you gave your speech and you talked about her, and that was seen as a very new age, that the sense that you could talk about emotions and you could talk about issues. And do you think that was very specific to you?
Yeah, well, we were a different generation of people. And suddenly, you know, that was why we got that landslide victory in 1997, is that the zeitgeist had changed. Yeah. Mm. And we were representatives of that. In a sense, she was a representative of it, actually. And so, yeah, all of that changed. And then, you know, there was big social change. I mean, people forget this now, but, you know, in the 1980s and indeed 1990s, support for gay rights was seen as extremist. Mm. You know, I think we were the first government to have a black minister, I think. First government to have a Muslim minister. First government to have a female foreign secretary, chief whip, you know, many more women in a cabinet than any government had done before. So we still obviously have a long way to go on all of those things, but, you know, it was a change. It was a social change. Mm. We managed to do that social change because we did it in a way that didn't alienate that somewhat small C conservative center ground. More important than virtually anything else we did was to make law and order a major part of our pitch. And I did that for reasons of belief, but it also served a very important political purpose. It meant that those working class communities that probably thought about some of our policies around, you know, gay rights, social change, those small C conservative working class communities, on the other hand, they got completely what we were trying to do on law and order.
And on institutions, didn't you? So in a sense, I don't know whether it was to do with your mother, but you were never sort of antagonistic to the royal family itself. In a way, with the Queen, you felt very much that when Princess Diana died, it wasn't that you were trying to...
Yeah, because it's part of your job is to try and keep the country together. Mm-hmm. And I was aware of the fact there was a very strong feeling at that point against the royal family, but I was also aware of the whole section of the British public, including people like my dad, who would have been horrified if I'd used that to sort of turn it into a rant against the monarchy. And, you know, I will say to people, my generation's come to a kind of settled view, I think, about the monarchy, which is not one of deference, but one of saying, well, this is an institution that holds the country together, and provided duty is their foremost thing, which by and large it is, by the way, in my view, then that's fine. You know, it's not that you've got some sort of, you know, you're not going to be putting pictures of the royals all over your walls necessarily, but
you're respectful of the institution, respectful of the fact that a large part of the British population are very fond of them. And, you know, this is, it's, and it's all, it's also about having the maturity to choose your battles. You know, so fighting low pay really matters to me. You know, fighting the monarchy doesn't, even if I've felt differently about them.
Ruth Davidson ruled herself out from being a number 10 because she said she wasn't mentally robust enough, that she was worried that you had to be really strong. Do you think that is some quality that you do need if you're a number 10? Is it incredibly tough
yes,
there? And do you need to be a strong enough
You need to be very
person?
Robust. I mean, I think it's a shame if Ruth felt like that or feels like that because she's a huge political talent, I think. But yeah, no, you've got to be prepared for that. It's because you're taking decisions all the time that affect people, and they're all difficult, or most of them are difficult.
Did you ever get depressed at all?
I got, no, not depressed, anxious. Yeah, anxious.
How did that manifest itself?
Just you feel very worried, you're agonising over things, but you realise you've got to take the decisions. There's no doubt, and you know, this is why now, okay, it's all very well for someone like me to sit there and say, well, look, Boris Johnson should be doing this or should be doing that. But, you know, one thing I've learned since leaving office is that it's easier to give the advice than take the decision. But, you know, if you're actually in his position, say around some of the things that he's deciding, you know, you've got to take a decision. And whatever you take, decision you take, someone will tell you it's the wrong one.
Did you feel hurt when people stopped liking you? So do you mind when people say you're a war criminal, or when, you know, you get absolutely berated on Twitter? How does that make you feel as a person? I mean, or do you just feel incredibly thick-skinned about it?
No, I don't think anyone's ever that thick-skinned. I mean, of course you don't like it and it's not pleasant. But on the other hand, you can't be intimidated by it. One of the things you realise about the job is you mustn't be intimidated.
Did you read your own press or not?
Not much. I've never been a great one for that, actually. Mm. I never watch myself on TV. Well, actually, occasionally I do, but not nearly as much as many people are.
Are you on Twitter?
No, the Institute's on Twitter. But, you know, you read some of this stuff on social media and you think, what gets into these people that write this stuff? I mean, honestly.
But also you get it more from the left than the right, actually.
Well, I get it from both sides, in fact, because the social change and the pro-European is offends the right nowadays. But these people do it to intimidate, and therefore you've got to, it's very important that you stand up to them.
Mm. Do you worry more about how you're seen historically then, do you think? Is that something you worried about at all when you were Prime Minister, or that you do now?
I think you can never tell, so there's no point in worrying about it. You can't really affect that. What I did worry about as I went on, and really people, I think, don't fully understand this about what I became eventually, is I actually just did what I thought was right towards the end.
And do you think that was the right thing to do?
I think it was the right thing to do, but I'm not sure it was very sensible politically and personally.
Well, there's the danger of you get sort of detached from the public.
Yeah, but it's not. You can be detached from the public. It's different from deciding that you're going to just blow with the wind.
Mm.
And I was very, very determined by the end of it. By the end of it, I came to the conclusion that your actual responsibility is just to do what you think is right. Now, you may be wrong, and you've got to accept that. And there's lots of things, because what you realise over time as the problem as Prime Minister is that there's a lot of things that you don't know about, but you're having to take decisions about, or you don't know in the depth that you'd like to know it. And, you know, I've learned a huge amount since I left office. I mean, I'd be different today if I was back in office.
Do you worry about the future now?
Well, it depends. If these things go in cycles, and if the Labour Party corrects itself and gets back to, you know, a serious modern progressive position, then no, it can change. And, you know,
and you've been living with your son Leo the last few weeks. Does that give you optimism about the next generation and the future? Do you look at them and think they're more altruistic or more political, or Is there a sense?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic about them. I think they're a very committed group of young people. There's a lot of idealism there.
Would you want him to go into politics?
If he wanted to, I would.
Do you think any of them will?
I don't know. I mean, in for the older ones, the problem, because they're in their early 30s now, the problem with them is that they and their friends have been, you know, sort of shut. If they're not conservatives, the Labour Party's been pretty much closed to them. So it's difficult for them. But that may change in time. Who knows?
Do you mean because it's too left-wing or because they're your children?
Well, a bit of both, I guess. But it's, you know, it's possible that can, these things go in cycles, don't they? So it can change. I don't know any of them will do. I mean, Leo's very interested in politics, but whether he'd ever want to go into it or not, I don't know.
And what do you think your father would think now if he was here? How would he perceive the last few years? Because it seemed that Britain was going in a certain direction, then it really changed, didn't it, in the last decade?
Yeah, but my dad would probably have been... I mean, you know...
Would he have been a Brexiteer, do you think, or would have been...
Yes, I think so. If he'd been as he was, but, you know, who knows what he would... you can't really tell, because obviously he was from a different generation. Yeah, probably he would have been, because he was from that sort of wing of the Conservative Party, although you can never be sure.
Do you think your mum would have been proudest of that you did in your life?
Well, she would have been proud of becoming Prime Minister, yeah.
But what? that you did?
She'd have been surprised. She'd have been absolutely shocked.
Do you think? Why?
Because when she died, I was still a kind of rock and roll rebel, so she would have been very surprised.
Was it more likely to have been your older brother then?
Yeah, much more. But although my old brother was never very interested in politics as a career, he was a true lawyer.
So if you think back to yourself at 10, what would you say to your 10-year-old self now?
What you're feeling now is about right, so carry on. I don't think I would have... You know, what can you...
And what were you feeling? What do you mean?
That life does require a certain... sense of urgency and get up and go, and you are to a degree on your own, so make the most of it. So I think probably I don't know. I can't really think what I would say to him or what he'd say to me.
Is there anything you wish you'd known then that you know now?
Yeah, masses of things. But you know, that part of the trouble is I always remember saying to my mother when she was actually very ill, you know, if you could go back to being a young, my age again, and this would be when I was maybe 18 or 19, would you want to do it? And I was surprised at her answer, which was no.
Would you want to do what? Would you
go back to being young?
Oh, right. But you would you like to start again?
I'm not sure, because the thing is, you're aware of how much pain there is in the whole process of living. So if you kind of went back knowing what you know now, would you still have the same drive and energy?
It's also about luck as well, isn't it? And would you have the same luck?
Yeah,
so it isn't exactly all about drive and energy. Some of it's just about circumstance.
No, it's an absolute circumstance. And that's, I mean, I would never have become an MP in any normal set of circumstances, but just did in the circumstances of 1983. Mm-hmm.
And what do you think, what's the sort of single thing since your mother died that you've been proudest of?
I think raising a family that I like as well as love, which I think is not that usual.
Just the final one is, whether do you think having sort of some kind of trauma or adversity that you overcome when you're young, does that confer any kind of advantage in a way? Do you think there's a benefit to that? Even though it doesn't feel like it at
the time. I obviously now, having lived quite a long life and met a large number of very successful people in different walks of life, I think there's usually a spur somewhere. And spurs are painful. But out of that comes an intensity, not necessarily only of ambition, but a desire to achieve. And that's my general experience of the people who are successful. Not always, but usually there's been something in their background or their childhood or their circumstances that have kind of just dug into them and made them break into a gallop.
You've been listening to What I Wish I'd Known in association with Speakers for Schools, the youth social mobility charity that provides inspirational talks and work experience opportunities, with Rachel Sylvester
and Alice Thompson, and our guest on this episode, Tony Blair.
The series producer is Anya Pierce.
If you enjoyed what you heard, why not pick up a copy of our book, What I Wish I'd Known When I Was Young? Or you can follow the podcast so you never miss an episode. And of course, you can listen back to all our previous episodes on the free Times Radio app or download them from wherever else you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.